This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehiye Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
Deborah Malak says in order for Uganda to maintain its place as a stable democracy in Africa, Uganda needs a free and fair 2021 election.
That's Halima Tumani reporting from Kampala. Details coming up also. A pre-dawn attack on an army camp in central Mali yesterday kills about 20 soldiers. And many African sports fans are joining the world in mourning the death of U.S. basketball legend Kobe Bryant. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, a pre-dawn attack on an army camp in central Mali yesterday killed about 20 soldiers. The identity of the attackers was not immediately clear, but a government statement says terrorists entered the camp near the village of Sokolo, killed the soldiers, and caused significant material damage. The government says reinforcements have been dispatched to the scene and aerial reconnaissance is underway in the area to track down the attackers. Reuters reports that Islamist groups with links to Al-Qaeda and Islamic State operate in central and northern Mali and have used the area as a base to attack soldiers and civilians in neighboring Burkina Faso, Niger, and beyond. Former colonial power France intervened in 2013 to drive back militants who had seized northern Mali in 2012, and the UN Security Council deployed a peacekeeping mission known as MINSUMA. The militants were pushed back initially, but have since regrouped and strengthened in a sign of their success in MINSUMA has become the UN's deadliest mission. More than 4 months after most of Zimbabwe's public hospital doctors stopped going to work to protest low pay, normalcy is returning to hospitals. Zimbabwe's richest man, Strive Masiwa, intervened in the situation. Reporter Kuza Zenawashi has the details.
Most doctors in public hospitals said their salaries are too meagre for them to be able to afford transport to work, and they stopped going. Negotiations between doctors and the government have dragged on, with no resolution in sight. But a foundation founded by Zimbabwe telecommunications tycoon Strive Masiwa has made an offer to encourage doctors to work. Dr. Tawanda Zwakana is with the Zimbabwe Hospitals Doctors Association.
But from what we've seen, is that they are offering a monthly remuneration, more of a fellowship, training, scholarship. Because amongst the doctors, there are some who are still in training, some who have finished training.
The offer by the Higher Life Foundation pays the equivalent of $200 in local currency, which will add to the salary the government pays. Some doctors initially resisted the offer, arguing their pay should come from their employer, the government. Zwakana, however, says many have returned to work.
The situation on the ground has improved. Doctors are returning to work, mostly because of this latest development of the Higher Life Foundation. It gives us some relief and some capacity to return back to work, whilst we still continue to look for other long-lasting solutions to our challenges as doctors.
He adds that doctors remain hopeful the talks with government will continue and bring a permanent solution.
We've always been open for dialogue with the employer, but of late the employer has left the dialogue table. We don't know why. It's just decided to shun dialogue with the Zimbabwe Hospital Doctors Association. So as of this year, there hasn't been any talks with the ministry or the health service board. But as the ZHD, we will remain open for negotiations with the employer and even other developmental partners.
The Higher Life Foundation Fellowship Program is set to run for 6 months and then be reviewed. Zwakada says there's still a lot to be done in terms of sundries and quality up-to-date equipment in hospitals. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zinamashe from Harare.
Outgoing U.S. Ambassador to Uganda, Deborah Malk, has called on Uganda's security agencies to ensure freedom of expression and association as the country gears up for a tense election period. But the Ugandan government spokesperson says those angry over actions of security agencies should go to court. Halima Tumani reports from Kampala.
The outgoing ambassador has called on security forces to ensure that the Ugandan people have the ability to exercise their constitutional rights of freedom of assembly and expression. Deborah Malak says in order for Uganda to maintain its place as a stable democracy in Africa, Uganda needs a free and fair 2021 election. An election, she says, that allows dissenting opinions to be heard and where voters know they can trust that the votes they cast will be counted fairly. Malak said police are using the country's Public Order Management Act selectively to clamp down and arrest members of the opposition. The opposition members are trying to hold public consultation meetings and delegates' conferences ahead of the campaign period, which begins in August, leading to the 2021 general elections.
We hope that there will be some effort exerted to work with the security forces to help the police understand the proper interpretation and implementation of the Public Order Management Act. We know that that is a work in progress, and it will continue to get used as a very blunt weapon against real, imagined, or perceived opponents of the status quo.
Government spokesperson Ofwono Opondo, speaking to VOA, dismissed Malak's statement as useless, saying it's only the courts that can interpret the law.
I think in the application of the law and enforcement of the rule of law and order, the police in Uganda is right to act firmly within their jurisdiction. But assuming that there was misinterpretation or misapplication, what does POMA itself say? You seek redress in the courts of law or administrative law, go and challenge the arbitrariness of the police officer or police officers in courts of law.
The Public Order Management Act states that organizers of a meeting shall notify the police at least 3 days before the meeting takes place. Charity Ahimbisiwe, the national coordinator of the Citizens Coalition for Electoral Democracy in Uganda, says security forces ought to respect a 2016 Supreme Court ruling. The court stated that there was no level playing ground, especially for presidential candidates, in the run-up to the 2016 elections.
Because the police had been high-handed on opposition and not the NRM, which we are seeing playing out again right now, the Supreme Court judges did rule at the time that to make the field leveled, the police should be seen to protect all citizens equally. We have not seen that happening. We are seeing what we saw in 2016. So how do we then believe that anything can change?
President Yoweri Museveni, who has led Uganda since 1986, is expected to run again in the February 2021 election. His potential opponents include Robert Kyagulanyi, the legislator and musician better known as Bobi Wine. Wine has been arrested several times, most recently on January 6th when he tried to hold a public meeting at a church in Kampala. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Nearly 4 months after elections, the North African country of Tunisia still waits for its next government to take office. When that happens, it faces daunting challenges. The economy is shaky, but in the capital's ancient Medina area, some traders are struggling for manpower. From Tunis, Lisa Bryant reports on an effort to save them, which may offer bigger lessons for the country.
Historically, the Medina was the heart of trade and craft and art, and it's structured with many souks. Every souk is a is an alley or a street that is dedicated to a specific craft.
Leila Bin Ghassemi is giving a visitor a brief history of Tunis's centuries-old medina as she walks through its winding streets and describes each souk or bazaar.
So you have souk Shawashin, where all the Shashia artisans are lined up one after the other. You have the souk of souk Nhas, it's the coppersmith souk, and it was also the heart of the government.
Bin Ghassemi is not a tourist guide. She's a social entrepreneur. On this day, she's concentrating on another old craft as she visits the Medina's last bookbinder. 64-year-old Mohammed Bin Sessi shows some of the books he's restoring. There's a magnificent old Quran with blue and gold engraved pages. Bookbinding was not part of his family's tradition, but he fell in love with it 4 decades ago. The new generation is less enamored. Bin Sessi says there's still demand for bookbinders, but young people aren't interested in joining the trade. He's not the only artisan looking for skilled labor. In parts of the country, up to one-third of young Tunisians are unemployed. But here in the Medina, some venerated old trades risk going extinct, partly for lack of manpower. Bin Ghassemi says these trades are part of Tunisia's history and very identity.
I don't imagine a Tunisian family with that does not have an artisan. I mean, my mother, she embroidered most of what we use today in the house.
But now the country's traditional arts and crafts are under threat for a myriad of reasons. Tunisia's sinking economy and currency have made quality raw materials unaffordable for some craftsmen who have switched to more inexpensive options that cheapen the final product. Bin Ghassemi believes restoring artisanry's one central place means a broader rethink of one key economic driver.
We're not promoting Tunisia with all its wealth. And so far, I don't feel we have communicated the best story. I think we communicated the easiest story.
Tourists have long flocked to Tunisia's beaches. For many, exploring the country's cultural patrimony is secondary. A spiderweb of cobblestone streets and whitewashed houses, the Medina was founded in the 7th century. Today, it's a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It was restored under hardline president Zine El Abidine Ben Ali, then suffered under the 2011 revolution that ousted him.
C'était un peu ça la stratégie de l'association sauvegarde la Medina.
Architect Souled Aoudidi works for the Medina Preservation Association. The goal, she says, is not just to preserve the Medina's buildings, but also the people who live here.
Everything you see here is original. The tiles, the marble, the ironwork.
That's also Bin Ghassemi's goal. She's transformed two ancient buildings into boutique hotels and hired local residents to run them.
All our suppliers are micro businesses around us, and I think if investments are inclusive and pay attention to shared economy, then maybe the whole community will grow together.
Bin Ghassemi's shared economy mission is bigger than her two hotels.
In the 100 hectares central Medina, we still have today 525 artisan production workshops. Of course, this is a lot less than what it used to be. In fact, in the last 50 years, maybe the number went down to half.
She organizes workshops for her hotel guests, featuring local artisans like bookbinder Bin Sassi. It's one way tourists can appreciate and buy into these traditional crafts, one way to help preserve them.
Hello.
Bin Ghassemi also works with Mohammed Troudi. At 28 years old, he's the Medina's youngest manufacturer of Tunisia's famous flat-top Shashia hats that are in demand in North and Sub-Saharan Africa. Troudi shows a visitor his calloused hands. He says young people don't want to work. They want an office job with a computer, Facebook, and a morning coffee break. He points to a fellow shashia maker across the street. See that old man, he says? His son doesn't want to work in the trade. Trudy is afraid that one day the shop will close for good. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Tunis.
The killing of a Nigerian priest by Boko Haram has raised fresh concerns among Nigeria's Christian community that it is being targeted by the Islamist militants. The death came barely 2 weeks after President Muhammadu Buhari urged Nigerians to stop viewing acts of terror as a religious war. Timothy Abiezu reports from Abuja.
The Reverend Lawan Andimi was declared missing January 3rd after Boko Haram insurgents raided his village in Mitika in northeastern state of Adamawa. He headed the state's chapter of the Christian governing body, Christian Association of Nigeria, CAN. The insurgents murdered him on Monday while negotiations for his release were ongoing, an event that has triggered widespread criticisms of the government by the Christian body. Security analyst Ebenezer Oyetakin says the killing was intended to incite religious tensions between the two major religious groups in the country.
The Muslim and the Christians in Nigeria and the citizens must know that the instrument these external forces and their internal collaborators are exploiting are our fault lines of tribes, religion, and ethnicity. So the Nigerian people should unite against them. I personally, as a Christian, I do not see the killing of the CAN chairman in Adamawa as a target against Christian. It is a target against the nation exploiting our fault line.
Boko Haram often holds some captives on the basis of their faith while setting others free. The Christian Association of Nigeria, CAN, accuses authorities of not doing enough to secure the release of abducted Christians. Security expert Senator Irebu shares that opinion.
You cannot lie that Christians are not targeted because that's the reality. And you will say they should not stop complaining because that's the reality. If CAN chairman is kidnapped, if terrorists abduct people and segregate Christians and held them captive, you won't say it's not there. It's there. So what are you doing to ensure that this set of people are not vulnerable to this kind of terrorist onslaught?
Oyetakin says concerns about religious tensions can be avoided if the government was more proactive.
The government must govern in such a way that regenerates a bond of national unity.
Earlier this month, President Muhammadu Buhari urged Nigerians to stop seeing acts of terrorism as a religious war. On Tuesday, he reacted to the killing of a priest using his official social media account. The president said he was, I quote, greatly saddened by the fact that the terrorists went on to kill him, even while giving signals of willingness to set him free by releasing him to third parties. This barbarism is condemnable. We will ensure that these terrorists pay a heavy price for their actions, end quote. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Cane weaving is a Nigerian art that is decades old, but the demand for imported furniture in the country has hurt the business, and many involved in the craft struggle to make a living. However, a government ban on furniture imports is boosting sales of locally made cane furniture. We have Timothy Obiezu again to report on what cane weavers in Abuja have to say.
From cutting to framing, slicing and hand weaving, Sonny Anibodi followed his older brother in this craft more than two decades ago. Cane weaving is part of his culture in Edo State in southern Nigeria, but Anigwede says he's in Nigeria's capital in the hope of better business opportunities.
Started this work when I was in secondary school. I was just doing it as a part-time stuff, so before it became a professional work for me.
Cane is a type of perennial grass with a flexible wooden stalk that can be used for making baskets, chairs, even roofs. Cane weaving artistry dates back decades in Nigeria, and all the materials are sourced locally. But Nigeria's high demand for imported furniture means craftsmen like Anigbode struggle to stay in business.
Whatever you do, they will say this is a local product. Even when you put in your best to meet a Western standard, there is this belief, okay, is it not produced here? It is because they have that alternative of having the foreign product. And because of our mindset as especially Nigerians, we believe that anything that is coming from abroad is better than what we have here.
But this year, the Nigerian government ordered the restriction of imported products into the country, including furniture. The government says it wants to improve on local business and boost production. Economist Nonso Obikili says a ban like this could have a negative impact on Nigeria's economy.
Even in the healthiest economies, you find that there is a balance between imports of any particular item, including furniture, and those that are locally produced. It's the same everywhere. Now, in terms of a ban, theoretically, bans tend to be negative overall.
While cane weavers hope to see this ban turn around their businesses, furniture dealers like Emmanuel Onwe are also taking steps. After years dealing in imported upholstery, Onwe is trying to introduce cane furniture on the side.
This is something we can move if our Nigerian government can stop importation of those things, because the China one, when they import, you know, they last.
Nigeria imported more than $163 million in furniture last year. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
Many African sports fans are joining the world in mourning the death of U.S. basketball legend Kobe Bryant. Bryant, who was 41, and his 13-year-old daughter Gianna were among nine killed Sunday in a helicopter crash outside Los Angeles. They reportedly were on their way to a basketball tournament for youngsters. Authorities are investigating the cause of the crash. Bryant goes down in history as one of the greatest professional basketball players ever to step onto the court. He spent his entire pro career with the Los Angeles Lakers, winning five NBA championships. National leaders and basketball fans from around the world issued messages of sorrow and shock. Italy's AC Milan football club, of which Bryant was a huge fan, called him one of the greatest sportsmen of all time. A native of the U.S. city of Philadelphia, Bryant spent much of his youth in Italy, where his father played pro basketball. Bryant's life was not without controversy. A female hotel worker accused him of rape in 2003. A court dismissed the charge, but Bryant settled the civil suit the woman filed. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
This is James Butte, Managing Editor and host of VOA's Daybreak Africa show. Join us Monday through Friday at 03, 04, 05, and 0600 hours UTC as we bring you the latest Africa news, features, and sports. You can also be a part of Daybreak Africa through our mail segment by sending your comments to daybreakafrica at voanews.com. That's Daybreak Africa right here on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 17:05 UTC on The Voice of America.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the Sunny Side of Sports, Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.